You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 24th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On the program today, John Neffel, just returning from a trip to Guantanamo Bay on the battle to make the military commission's trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other defendants in the attacks on 9/11 more transparent. Also on the program, from the archives, Stephen Vittoria, the filmmaker behind One Bright Shining Moment, the documentary from 2005, The Forgotten Summer of George McGovern. That will be available only for members. But all of you will hear the John Neffel interview. I am not in today. This is a pre-record. But even still, I said, you know what? I got to give those people who listen to the show on a daily basis some content. I don't know why. I don't know why I did it. Matt told me to. And also, this is an important story that John Neffel has reported on that, sadly, in the context of... Well, it's sad for two reasons. One is, sadly, in the context of a presidential race, we don't hear much other news. And sadly, because this will be news for a long, long time. And going forward, what John Neffel reports on will be an important element as to the legitimacy of these military commissions to the extent that they can have any. So, first up will be John Neffel, and then members will hear from the filmmaker behind One Bright Shining Moment. Interesting interview. At the time, back in 2006, when we first ran this interview, when we first actually did it on the old Majority Report, it was April 17th, 2006, I think we anticipated the former senator calling into the program. And if I recall correctly, there was, I believe, a health issue that day that made it impossible for him to call in, which was unfortunate from my perspective, because, I mean, I did ultimately get a chance to meet him in the Air America studios at one point, I think a year or two later. And I think I've told this story on the program about... my family, I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts, and someone down the road from us was working on the McGovern campaign. He wanted to do a stop in Worcester, and we had a big backyard, not acres and acres, but big backyard for Worcester. And apparently my parents said yes. And as a six-year-old kid, I... recall, there were tons of cops who showed up. And my mom tells me that a senator from Alaska at the time, I can't remember which one it was now, off the top of my head. It was not Gravel, though, I don't think. Showed up at the house, and I guess we had dinner with him. McGovern showed up, and all I do remember, distinctly, I remember McGovern, but I really remember Roger Mudd, who was a reporter and I think sometimes an anchor for, I think it was NBC News. And just tons and tons of motorcycle cops. And so for about a year and a half, 2 years after that, whenever my parents had a dinner party or any people over, I wore my Speed Racer helmet and walked around the house with a billy club. So that's the type of kid I was. Really, really problematic. So that was my first introduction to politics at that time. And I'm sure I shook his hand, and this film really, it really is a must-watch. The interview is definitely worth a listen to. And, of course, members will have that. And now, first, John Neffel. We will be back live tomorrow, Thursday. We'll be right back. Well, we'll be right up with this interview next. Back on the Majority Report, Sam Cedar on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program John Neffel. He is an independent journalist and host, or co-host, I should say, of Radio Dispatch. Is that at radiodispatch.com?
That's correct.
And you've got a piece about this coming up at The Nation either today or tomorrow. People can check it out at nationmagazine.com. So, John, you went down to Guantanamo to cover part of, at least, the military commissions that are taking place, trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others for war crimes in regarding their involvement in 9/11. Why did you go down there?
What sort of sparked my interest initially was a motion that the ACLU filed to address the court on this sort of overly restrictive ways that the prosecution, that the government was trying to silence the accused, the five defendants. And the government's position initially was that literally every utterance out of the five defendants' mouths was presumptively classified and would therefore have to be treated as a secret and not admissible in open court. And that position has subsequently been weakened, although it's not clear by how much. And that was the last part that it's not clear by how much is the kind of fundamental principle of what it's like to witness this military commission at Guantanamo Bay. It's a process that's being created before your eyes. Amnesty International said that after watching the week's proceedings, that one thing was clear: the government is making it up as they go.
And so this is important because, I mean, obviously, there was an attempt at one point to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in federal court in New York City, which, of course, was sort of the precedent set, or I mean, the precedent was set long before that, but certainly the way that we dealt with the attack on the first attack on the World Trade Centers back in 93. And so we have this this regime, I guess, of military commissions, which like you say, are being sort of developed as the trial, for lack of a better word, proceeds. What is it that the defense feels is necessary? I mean, why is this relevant to the defense? I mean, obviously, it becomes very difficult to have any type of transparency when the defendants cannot really speak on the record without it, or a record that we can all see. But what is it that the defense argues will come out of their testimony?
Well, in some ways, the defense doesn't quite know. They are barred, in some instances, from even talking to their clients about their treatment in the rendition, interrogation, and detention program that was run by the CIA. So, and to the extent that the attorneys do know how it would affect their case, they are barred from saying it publicly because it's classified information and they could be put in jail for even discussing it. So in terms of how it would sort of strategically be used, we don't really have a sense of that. But in terms of the language that the government is using, so they say that the thoughts, experiences, and memories of the defendants are classified. And one of the sort of words that was really bandied about a lot over the course of the week while I was there was Orwellian. And it really does have a sort of Orwellian overtones, because the government's position is that to properly classify information, that information has to be under the control of the U.S. government. And so what they're saying is that because the bodies of the accused are under U.S. control, so too is their subjectivity, which is a really chilling claim for all sorts of obvious reasons. And it's that kind of secrecy and lack of transparency that the defense is so, really appalled about. And one of the other sort of really key elements to this is that the Hamdan case was just overturned by the D.C. Circuit Court. And so there's a sort of palpable nervousness around all these commissions that they might not stand up on appeal. And I think that there's also a sense that if they don't look fair, if they don't appear fair and transparent, which, I mean, I think that they can't by definition, but to the extent that they can look fair, they will have a much better chance of satisfying the public and also standing up on appeal. And the more secret they are, the less transparent they are, the more it's going to feel to the public like it's a show trial.
Right. I mean, to the extent that the public seems to be even aware of it at this point.
That's the other thing, is that it's virtually absent from the national discourse.
The timing's, you do it during an election, I guess, that sucks the oxygen out of this thing. And I want to get back to the Hamdan case in a moment, because and talk about why, how it's distinguished in the ruling in that case, and how it may or may not impact this one. But ostensibly, I imagine that part of what the defense wants to enter into the record is the way that these defendants were treated and under what circumstances they supposedly gave evidence that is going to be used by the prosecution.
Right. I mean, I think that certainly the defense wants to be able to talk about the circumstances under which these, their clients may have signed, confessions or given up information or anything like that. One thing that's also worth noting about that specific topic is that the Military Commissions Act of 2009 that sought to sort of, make the Military Commissions Act of 2006 better is that it's more difficult now to get evidence that was obtained through torture into court, which is certainly a step in the right direction, although it's still not impossible. And this sort of open secret, I think, of a lot of people who are there who are critical of what's going on is that there's just no way that the government will allow these guys to talk about what happened to them. I mean, I think that if that was going to happen, it could potentially happen in a civilian court. But I think the very reason that the case is happening in Guantanamo Bay is to maintain those kind of secrets.
And of course, if the prosecution is successful in deeming everything that the defendants would say about their treatment and their apprehension as a government secret, then it also forecloses really any opportunity in any type of a civil action that these defendants might take.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the implications for what the prosecution is doing are really quite broad, and they also they're setting a precedent here. You know, there's still 166 people at Guantanamo Bay. Some of those people will be tried using the military commissions. And the kind of rules that are established here, and, you know, this is a capital case, so it could result in the death of these five guys. The rules that are established in this case could have far-reaching implications. I questioned General Mark Martins, who's the lead prosecutor and one of the architects of the 2009 Military Commissions Act, and I said, are we in danger of creating an entirely alternative legal framework here that's separate from civilian courts? And what he sort of said eventually, he said that he shouldn't comment, but this is really, this is his life and his legacy, and so he desperately wanted to sort of push back against my assertion. And he eventually said that this is an instrumentality or an authority that the government needs to preserve. And so that's not to suggest that this system will be applicable to U.S. citizens anytime in the near future, but it's just simply to recognize that once a government claims a power, and especially once the executive branch claims a power, it's virtually impossible to get them to relinquish that.
And we're not just talking about creating a distinct system of justice outside of civilian courts. We're also talking one outside of the sort of the military process of justice that we have known prior to now.
Right. It's the manual for military commissions is a rule book that's taken mostly from courts martial rules and a little bit from federal court. And it's, you know, what we're seeing is a sort of a mix of these two systems to create this this universe where there's virtually no case history. So, you know, there's no precedent. There's one of the really amazing things to witness this the past week when I was there was the process by which the defense is allowed to call witnesses. And it's a very basic rule, and it's very clear how you call and compel witnesses in federal court. It's very clear how you do it in court martials. But part of the 2009 update to the Military Commissions Act sought to make the commissions more like federal court. And so that had implications for how witnesses were called. And what happened over the course of the week was the defense argued that the existing rules were unconstitutional, and it got a little bit in the weeds, but the larger the larger point is that the defense doesn't know how to call and compel witnesses, which, again, when we're talking about a capital case, I think that should be incredibly troubling to anyone who's paying attention.
Now, contextualize the Hamdan ruling in the context of this, and just go back and because it's the latest Hamdan ruling essentially said was specific to Hamdan in terms of a particular class, if you will, of defendants who were tried under a regime that was found to be unconstitutional. Would Hamdan be able to be tried under the new regime, I guess, is the amended military commissions from 2006 and 2009?
Possibly. I'm not entirely sure what the answer to that would be. But, yeah, Hamdan didn't stand up. The case didn't stand up on appeal because the crime that he was accused of wasn't a crime when he was originally accused of it, and so that's why his case got overturned. But it sort of does loom in people's minds down there of, are they going to spend 10 years on this trial? And because there's such a lack of precedent, you know, is the defense going to be able to appeal on all these kind of rules that are being created on the fly? And there's a real danger in having a ruling that won't stand up on appeal, and then you get into this nightmare situation. And again, this is going to be years and years in the future, but there's this potential nightmare situation where the military commissions find these five guys guilty. The federal, the Article III courts, the civilian courts, overturn the ruling on appeal. And then you just get back to the period of indefinite detention because, the government is not going to let these five guys walk. It's inconceivable. And so there's just no, I think, way for this to feel like it's going to be settled after just the commission itself.
And so where does it stand now? I mean, the ACLU and these other groups have sort of filed this motion that would prevent the government from suppressing these statements about the way that they were treated, about the way that they were apprehended, any type of torture, abuse, or coercion that took place in terms of their testimonies. So are we waiting for this motion to be resolved before the proceedings can go forward? What happens now?
Yeah, we're waiting on the judge's ruling. There's another case that's happening this week, and this particular judge will sometimes allude to what he's thinking in court, but my understanding is that he generally sort of reserves his rulings to release them when they're written instead of given orally. So we don't know where a lot of these motions stand. It's possible that we'll be surprised and that the judge will sort of find in favor of the defendants and to sort of create the appearance of a more open court, but we don't know where it stands yet. The next set of the next pretrial hearings are going to happen either in December or January, depending on scheduling. And the judge essentially said, and then every other month, until the trial starts is how people should put it on their calendar.
And who is this judge? I mean, is the judge comes from the federal court system, or they come from the military system? Where do these judges come from?
Well, so he's an Army judge, Army Colonel James Pohl. He is retired, was retired and is now on a yearly contract basis with the government. He comes from the court-martial system, and one of the common refrains actually from him the entire week was he would often say, as people constantly remind me, I'm not a federal judge. And he sort of said it with a sense of humor, and he's this sort of chagrin almost. But he's a member of the California State Bar, but he is not a federal judge, and there are times when his unfamiliarity of the federal system really shows, and that's not a critique of him personally, but it is a critique of the fact that the system that he's supposed to shepherd to a just conclusion is, I think, by definition, it's so broken and so vague and unclear that he's in an incredibly difficult position.
Right. I mean, that seems to me to be a feature rather than a bug, right? I mean, you want to bring in a
right.
judge who is not steeped in the Article III court system because they have spent a career honoring that system, essentially, and working within it. And I would imagine, although I'm sure the guy is fairly knowledgeable, but I would imagine it would be much harder to sort of shape these rules if one had come out of a foundation of working within that that civilian system.
Right. I think that's correct. And it's also worth reiterating the incredibly high conviction rate that federal courts have for terrorism cases.
Right.
Some people say that it's a 100% conviction rate. I think that that's a slight exaggeration, but it's not as though there have been no terrorism cases brought in federal court. And in fact, under the Bush administration, there were lots of terrorism cases in federal court, which the overwhelming majority resulted in convictions, sometimes in much harsher convictions than the few cases that have gone through the military commission system. So it's really not at all as though the federal courts are incapable of dealing with these kinds of cases. General Martins, again, in when he was responding to me, said the opposite. He said that you can't do these cases in federal court. And what that seems to me to mean is that you can't ensure convictions. That's certainly not how he would disagree with my characterization of his statement. But you can, I mean, it's really astounding for the prosecutor to say you can't do these in federal court, because you can, I mean, you can do these, of course you can do these in federal court. That's what Holder wanted to do. And so to say that you can't doesn't mean that the system isn't equipped to do it. It's just that it means that the system isn't as malleable as the military commissions.
And specifically malleable in terms of result. So give me, I'm just curious, give me a sense of just sort of experientially as someone who's going down there to report on this, just your experience in doing this, because, you know, the Guantanamo Bay is this sort of, I mean, in some respects, literally and figuratively, this sort of black hole of justice. And there's a reason why it's so, and it obviously it plays into sort of jurisdictional issues too, the fact that it's theoretically not part of the United States. Just tell me your experience. I mean, what were your thoughts when you first got to this, your first trip down there, right?
Yeah, my first trip down there. And you're absolutely right. It's very odd to be on a piece of land where you don't know if the Constitution applies or not. I mean, the Supreme Court in Boumediene and Hamdi said that at least part of the Constitution applies there. You have a right to due process and things like that. But it's clear that the government's position is that the Constitution doesn't fully apply otherwise they wouldn't be there.
Right.
So that's sort of strange. The other thing that's just incredibly bizarre when you're there is that, I mean, the weather is beautiful. We took a ferry from the airport to the side of the island that we had to go to that was lovely. There's a subway, there's a McDonald's, there's a huge shopping mall, a sort of, you know, Walmart kind of thing with a gift shop. You can buy Guantanamo Bay coffee mugs and shot glasses. There's a T-shirt sort of similar to a T-shirt that, you know, might say FBI or SWAT or whatever. There's a T-shirt that says Joint Task Force Guantanamo Bay Detainee Guards or something like that. And it's got a screen print of a chain link fence, barbed wire. It's sort of like when you go to San Francisco and there are all these T-shirts of Alcatraz. It's a kind of similar thing to that, which, you know, that's not the most significant part of the island, obviously, but it does create this really strange sort of cognitive dissonance while you're there. But the military people that we dealt with were, to a person, all wonderful to me and the other media people. And there's obviously a whole host of reasons for that. But they treated us really, really well. And it was sort of my first experience being in a situation like that, which is also, it's strange to be sort of, they drive you around, you put in your sandwich order in the morning, and then when you get back from court for lunch, there's a Subway sandwich waiting there for you. And so there's this real effort to be, I think, you know, to be welcoming and sort of make it feel like as pleasant an assignment as it can feel.
Right.
Like.
I mean, theoretically, and, right? You're supposed to be part of Team Guantanamo at that point, rather than being adversarial in some fashion.
Right, and I think that an extended, you know, being in that situation for an extended time, it's very easy to imagine intellectual capture happening. Although I will say that the reporters who I met down there were really incredibly knowledgeable and incredibly capable and able reporters, and so I don't think that. It wasn't my impression that anyone there was, it sort of in the bag for the military. And, I just sort of wanted to make that clear.
Yeah, I mean, tell me, so, I mean, like, is there, how I guess, broad or deep, and what is the size of the press pool down there? Like, I'm curious. I mean, I know that there's some great reporting that comes out of, I think it's the Miami Herald.
Yeah, that's Carol Rosenberg.
Right. And we don't, you know, we just don't see much reporting coming out of there. Rosenberg is the only person that, I can recognize by name that has been, she's been doing this for years now. But is there, I mean, does ABC or NBC, do they ever send anybody down there now? Or is it just like, what is the sort of the press apparatus to talk about these things?
Well, so AP sent a video person down. Sometimes Reuters sends a video team down. There were about 25 media members of the media there. Fox News sent somebody. The arraignment that happened in May was apparently much more attended by the media, and because it was the sort of first time that a lot of people had seen these guys, and that day really turned into a kind of it sounds like it was a kind of a circus in the court. It was a 13-hour day, and the accused were throwing paper airplanes and stuff like that. And so for that, there were, I think, you know, over 100 reporters, but this time it was just 25, give or take. There's, when you're there, you stay in a tent that houses, six people, and there's rows and rows of tents, and there are many filing centers. So I don't know what the sort of maximum capacity for reporters is, but you know, easily they can easily accommodate hundreds. Maybe that will happen the first week of the trial, if it ever gets to a trial. But you know, the other sort of issue that was certainly on my mind is that when this thing does go to a trial, you know, maybe it'll be 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and I'm sure that some media organizations will, you know, work in teams, and so you don't have to send somebody all the time. But it's a pretty grueling week. It's early mornings and late nights often. So when the trial actually does happen, it really is going to be important for a lot of reporters to go down there, just because there are so many stories that happen, because so much of what happens is unclear.
And lastly, I mean, it sounds like you were treated fairly well by your fellow reporters there. I wonder if there's, I mean, how they perceive you coming down to do a magazine feature, you know, from The Nation, as opposed to the reporters who may be sort of closer to the process.
Right. Well, I felt incredibly lucky that I didn't have to file every day, just because the pressure of that can get to be pretty grueling. But because I was able to sort of take in the whole thing, take in the week as a whole, it really allowed me to focus on the constitutional issues, the issues of chilling speech, and the sort of the, you know, whether or not you can classify somebody's subjectivity. And it sort of allowed me to really dig into those subjects, as opposed to, if you have to send in a story every morning, sometimes there's just nothing happens. And so it's sort of difficult to stay focused on the broader sort of implications of what's happening. And it's, you know, if you're sending in something every day, it's also, I think, more difficult to kind of challenge the overall framework and to just sort of accept the parameters that the government has set up, which, because I was able to have a lot more freedom, I feel like, I just have more freedom to do that. But as far as, sort of the more social aspect, everyone there was super nice. And, I think that there's a fair amount of camaraderie, to a certain extent down there, because you're in this really weird situation for a week, and the only people that you really interact with are the other reporters, and then occasionally, like sometimes, the military people.
Well, fascinating stuff. John Neffel, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and tell us about it. Appreciate the work you're doing. People can check out John's piece. It's in The Nation magazine either today or tomorrow. It will come out. And obviously, go to radiodispatch.com, where he hosts, is it daily, the show, or a couple times a week?
It's Monday through Thursday.
There you go. Nice schedule. I like that.
Yeah. Oh, well, thanks so much for having me on, Sam.